We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producer for the program is Jason Croft. Producer for the program is Harriet Williamson, and Jason Croft is the guy at the controls. In this part of the show, we'll be talking about the Constitution, the Supreme Court, and religion in the public schools. Now, just recently, a couple of weeks ago, the folks at the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life announced the results of a survey that they'd done. It's a survey of religious knowledge of Americans. They were trying to find out what Americans knew about their own faith and the faith of others. And they asked questions about a number of things. Among them, they asked people what they knew about religion in public school. And they found out that 89% of the people in their survey knew correctly that the Supreme Court had ruled that it was unconstitutional for a teacher to stand in front of the class and lead the class in prayer. However, only 36% knew that schools may offer courses in comparative religion, and only 23% knew that teachers may read from the Bible if they're doing it as an example of literature. And what is clear, they concluded, is that there are many people who think the constitutional restrictions on religion in schools are actually tighter than they really are. The issue here, though, is difficult because it walks the line, as the Constitution does, walks the line between allowing a free expression of religion and promotion of religion. This morning in this part of the show, as we talk about religion in the public schools, we'll highlight one of the earliest court rulings in this area. It's a case known as McCollum versus Board of Education. It's a case that originated in Champaign, Illinois. It went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. It is the subject of a new documentary produced by a filmmaker in our area here, Jay Rosenstein, and it will premiere on our television station, WILL-TV, next week. You'll have two opportunities to see it. We'll talk more about that a little bit later. But joining us in this part of Focus to talk about some of these issues, we have Stephen Schifrin. He's professor of law at Cornell University, has been there since 1987. He's also taught at UCLA, Boston University, Harvard University, Seattle University, and University of Michigan. And in his teaching and research, one of his particular interests, constitutional law and also the First Amendment. And as we talk, questions here are certainly welcome. Now, we hope that people will keep their questions brief. Keep them on the topic, and remember that we're trying to get in as many different people as possible, but certainly your input is welcome, as always. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free number, good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And we have email that's will-talk@illinois.edu. So certainly at any point here in the conversation, questions, comments from people are welcome. And we want to say hello to Professor Schifrin. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you, David. A pleasure to be here.
As a way of getting started here, I want to refer back again to the survey by the folks at the Pew Forum. And it seems indeed that people are confused about what sort of religious activity is and is not permitted. And in fact, in the report, I liked the phrase they use. They said that they thought people didn't really understand the distinctions between preaching and teaching. And I guess I wonder what you think about that and indeed this confusion over what you can and can't do.
Well, I'm not sure that the public is unaware of the distinction between preaching and teaching. It isn't surprising to me that they don't know what the law is in this particular area. But the law, as you described it, is correct. That is, you may teach about religion, but a teacher can't say that God exists, that Jesus Christ is a savior. A teacher can say that Christian religions believe that. Mm.
I want to hear touch on the McCollum case, and again, I think that perhaps this might also show how confusing that this can be. as in this particular case, what was at issue was they were religion classes in religion that were offered in the school during the school day, but they were not taught by the teachers. They were taught by people from the community who came into school, and in addition, they were not compulsory. The parents could opt out. They could say, no, I don't want my child to attend. And yet, even though it was not required and the teachers weren't teaching the classes, the Supreme Court, back there in 1947, 48, decided that this was unconstitutional.
I actually think it was a difficult case. On the side of the schools, the argument could have been, we don't want to hermetically seal our schools off from religion. On the other hand, we don't want to sponsor religions. We don't want to endorse religions. So what we're doing is allowing religious leaders to come into the schools and give education and preach their own specific religions without our endorsing what they are doing. The difficulties that were involved in the way it was set up was that first the superintendent of schools had to approve who was teaching. So it seems to me it would create a serious problem for a superintendent to say, well, I'm not going to let this rabbi come in because this rabbi is crazy. The more serious problem was the stigmatization of those people who didn't go to the religious classes. Your documentary shows that that was an extremely serious problem. And although the court, however, did not rest its decision on that, the court essentially said you cannot use the compulsory machinery of the state to enforce the attendance, even if that attendance is voluntary in terms of the parents signing off on it.
Yeah. So it, clearly, as you say, in this particular case, and if people see the documentary, they'll know the story, that part of the concerns here of Vashti McCollum, the woman who brought the case, was the way that her son, Jim, was treated when he when she decided that she didn't want him to attend these classes. He was subject to a lot of harassment, and in fact, in the community at that time, the family was also subject to a lot of harassment.
Correct. And in fact, I have a book called The Religious Left and Church-State Relations in which I discuss the McCollum case, and I hadn't seen your documentary, and I didn't know about this harassment. But I thought it was a close case, but I ultimately thought this creates too much of a risk of harassment, and I therefore thought that the McCollum decision was properly decided.
And just a couple of years after that, just to show the distinction here, there was a similar case that dealt with the same issue, something called release time, where students were allowed to take time off during the school day for religious classes, but they left the school. They went someplace off school property to attend those classes, and then the other kids, they were expected to be at school. So if you didn't go to the class, you still had to be in school. But in that particular case, the court ruled that that was okay. And it seemed that the only real distinction is that the classes weren't actually being held at the school during the school day. And in the McCollum case, there was also this conflict of interest, this involvement of school officials, even though they weren't teaching it. So clearly the important thing was what was happening there on school property during the school day with the involvement of school officials.
Yes, I think there are two points to be made about that case, the name of which is Zorach versus Clausen. The first is that it, I think, creates a very similar risk of harassment for those who stay behind. Imagine, for example, in a heavily religious area, imagine Salt Lake City, Utah, where the overwhelming majority of students are leaving to go to a Mormon church and one person stays behind. The second thing is that in McCollum, the students who were not attending the religious classes were attending other classes. The students in Zorak who stayed behind were in a study hall. And Justice Jackson, in a concurring opinion, said that he didn't see why students should be required to stay in jail while other students went elsewhere, that they should at least be afforded – well, he didn't say this, but I would say they should at least be afforded some secular class while others are going to religious classes.
Yeah. And perhaps another point we should make about the McCollum case is that at the time this was a – this made national news. It was covered by media across the country. People were very interested in this, perhaps in part because in schools, in public schools all over America, similar classes were being held. So Champaign wasn't just the only place that this was happening.
Yes, it was a decision of pragmatic significance in many school districts across the country, and it was the first decision in which the court held that a state or local law violated a religious provision in the Constitution. The Establishment Clause of the Constitution.
Over the years, a number of other cases would follow, and there have been a number of other rulings. Many of them have to do with prayer, with who can pray in school, and can prayers be given before some sort of particular event. Questions of, for example, before a football game, could a student get up and read a prayer over the public address system for everybody there? So it seemed that another issue, a number of other issues, and also there's the issue of can a student religious organization use the school for a meeting? These things have come later, so maybe now what's taught and whether people can pray are the things that preoccupy us. I just would like to, again, make sure that we put this particular case, because it's one of the earliest ones, in some sort of context among all of these cases that have to do with religious activities in school.
I think, although it was a big step by the court when it did it in, I believe, 1961 in Engle versus Vitale, there the court said that the New York State Board of Regents could not create a prayer to be given in schools. And the court ultimately said that the Lord's Prayer could not be said in schools. I think that's foreshadowed by McCollum. I mean, if you can't have people come in to give classes in Catholicism or Judaism, surely the state ought not to be able to have a school-sponsored prayer in the schools.
They also, though, and you know, do correct me if I'm wrong, though, that even if this was something that was initiated by and done by a student, the court also ruled that that's not allowed either.
To the extent it's part of an official state-sponsored activity, that's correct. On the other hand, let's suppose that in after hours, the Christian society has a classroom in which they pray, or they have it in the morning. That is constitutionally protected because it doesn't have the imprimatur of the state. Groups might be meeting for a wide variety of purposes. So that's considered to be freedom of speech rather than state endorsement of religion.
And that is – I think that is another one of these instances where I'm not sure how well people understand that, because they have this idea, well, there can be no religion in school. And in fact, that the court did rule, as you explained, that and apparently if you have student organizations and you allow them to use the facility for meetings outside of the school day – that as long as you have any kind of student group, you know, if you have a chess club and they meet in an empty classroom after school, that then if a group of students wants to have a Bible study group and they also want to meet in an empty classroom at the end of the school day, that's allowable. That you can't discriminate according to the particular activity, the interest of the group.
Yes, that's basic free speech law, that you can't have content regulation. And imagine if it were a different rule. Imagine teachers policing the rooms to make sure that no prayer is said before the beginning of the chess club. and engaging in ad hoc censorship on that basis. It would be a nightmare to administer. It's a fairly clean rule this way, and there's no reason to stop it. The religion clauses are designed to stop the state from endorsing religion, not to prevent students from praying.
Mm-hmm. And just and
now there is, to complicate this further, there is a case in which the court says that it is okay to begin the school day with a moment of silence. And it seems to me it should be obvious to everyone that the reason why a state or municipality or school district would have a moment of silence would be either to encourage or at least to permit students to engage in prayer at the beginning of the day. Mm-hmm. But the court didn't want to look at what the purpose was. The court said this is okay. It isn't a prayer. It's a moment of silence.
So as long as the school is not saying what it is that you should be doing during that moment, that just then saying we're going to have this moment of silence, even though a lot of people would say, well, we really know what it is. You know, somebody is intending here. The court has said, well, as long as it's left open to, you know, not thinking anything, then that's okay.
That's correct. Mm.
And that so there actually that was one where wasn't sure whether the court had actually made a ruling on that. So the court has indeed said, as long as the school doesn't say what you're supposed to be doing, moment of silence is okay.
That's correct. Mm.
Our guest in this part of Focus is professor of law from Cornell University Law School, Stephen Schifrin, and he's interested in, among other things, the First Amendment and also of constitutional law. And he is here talking with us about religion in the public schools. And in part, we're doing this just also to make sure that people know about a new documentary that profiles the case that we've talked about here, the McCollum case. It started here in Champaign, went all the way to the Supreme Court, and this was one of the earliest court decisions having to do with religion in the public schools. It's a brand new documentary produced by a member of our journalism faculty here at the U of I. We're going to be showing it on our television station next week, and we definitely want people to know about it. The program is called The Lord Is Not on Trial Here Today. It's a one-hour documentary. We're going to be showing it twice. You can see it next week, Tuesday evening, 7 o'clock. And then on Friday night, this is the 15th, we're going to show it. And then after that, I'll be sitting down with Jay Rosenstein, who's the producer, and also Dan McCollum, who is one of the McCollum family. It was his older brother, Jim, who was the guy really that was at the center of this case. But certainly Dan can reflect some on what the experience was for his family and going through this. So that'll be live. We'll be live in the studio on Friday, October 15th, and we'll show the documentary first, and then we'll have some conversation after, and people will be welcome to share their thoughts and comments with us. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. We have a caller here to bring into the conversation, someone in Montgomery on our line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. You know, good topic about this religion and be able to speak your piece of the First Amendment. I do believe that every person should have the right to either practice their prayers or speak their piece, especially speak their piece at any given time at anywhere. The problem we seem to have as a nation is that if we don't like something, we figure out a way to get rid of it. And whether we like it or not, it's here to stay. We start taking our freedoms away, then this nation doesn't stand for anything anymore. I do believe, and I know other places that do this, where they do hold prayer at the beginning of the school day, but it's at, you know, what students want to go and pray. In other words, it's open. They also have Muslims that do their thing, and they have atheists that do their thing, so and they seem to be all happy campers, and nobody's arguing. So I don't know why people have to get so hung up on the religion thing. As long as it's not offered as a class, I think we're okay. Don't you think so?
Well, I certainly agree with you that students ought to be able to pray in a school day. I do not think that the state should be able to sponsor a prayer. I believe that the Establishment Clause of the Constitution should and does stand for the proposition that the state is not a theologian. We don't want the state to be making theological judgments to decide which religion is right and which religion is wrong. That, it seems to me, would harm religion, not help it.
And I think I kind of think that you and the caller here essentially are on the same page, because I think what he's arguing for people's right to their religious expression, and that is indeed what that first part of that Establishment Clause on the First Amendment says, and that people have the right to exercise their religion. It's the place that we get into the difficulty is the second part, and making a judgment about whether government is somehow putting its stamp on a particular practice or a particular faith. And it seems that that's something that we continue over time to wrestle with, maybe now more in the activities that happen in the public square, so to speak. And yet it's something that we still argue about, well, what does or does not constitute establishment of religion?
True. And to just further complicate this, I just got through saying that the state should not be able to make theological judgments. But there is one major exception to this. The state says, "In God we trust" on our coins and currency. It says, "God save this honorable court" at the beginning of a Supreme Court session. The Pledge of Allegiance in the public schools says, "Under God, with liberty and justice for all." And I think it wildly unlikely that any of those practices will be declared unconstitutional. It is the exception that proves the rule. And it is constitutional because of a long history. It does have regrettable consequences, is in that it discriminates against Buddhists, Hindus, atheists, and agnostics, but it is a part of our tradition.
Has anyone, let us just say, for example, let's take the fact that it says, "In God we trust" on our currency. Has anyone ever tried to make a case over that?
I'm not aware of anyone trying to make a case about that. There are legal commentators who have expressed the view that it should be unconstitutional. There was a famous case involving a challenge to "Under God" in the Pledge of Allegiance that got to the Supreme Court, and most of the court got rid of it by saying that it was wrongly before them, that the person who had brought the case really didn't have standing to bring it. But three justices did reach the merits, and it's very difficult to write an opinion explaining why it's constitutional, but they and I believe they took the wrong tack. They essentially argued that "Under God" in the Pledge of Allegiance is not religious. I consider that blasphemous. Of course it's religious. It expresses the view that God exists and that God has ethical standards that bind this nation. It's clearly a theological judgment. I think the better explanation has to do with the fact that our Constitution is immersed in a religiously saturated culture, that we may be moving toward separation of church and state that would invalidate that. But I believe that we are more than a century away from that time.
Ah, so you think, given enough time, that might happen. There might be some court in the future that would make that ruling.
Yeah, I think it's not going to be in my lifetime. Yeah. There's a book that came out yesterday, actually, called "American Grace," which argues that at the moment we have gone to 17% of the American public who say that they are not religious, and that group is concentrated among young people. If that were to expand considerably, then I could see a court confronting the pluralism of our society and striking it down. But it would be the risk from the standpoint of the court would be that there would be a constitutional amendment 5 minutes later.
We have some other callers. Let's talk with someone in Indiana. This is someone listening in Lebanon, Indiana, line two. Hello.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen.
Yes.
Good morning.
What I'm about to say may be apocryphal. It seems like I heard, though, I don't remember what year the Supreme Court decision was, but either Senator Kennedy or then President Kennedy, when he was asked about the question, made the remark something along the lines of, well, let the children pray in church. Now, along that line of thinking, every grade school, junior high school, and high school I ever attended had numerous churches within a few blocks of the front door of any of those schools I attended, which has always made me think that really what the bottom line is here, at least amongst those who are in favor of prayer in church, and I'd like your opinion on this, is really it's another form of proselytizing and or trying to enforce upon all people that a Christian faith is the only normal and accepted faith in this land. And to that degree, the people that want to do that sort of thing are, to a degree, an awful lot like the Taliban in that sense. And I think they should be stopped at every turn and told, you know, if you want to pray, you got a church, you can pray at home, so on and so forth, but you don't got to do it in school. So your reaction to that, please, and thank you.
All right.
I think that's a very interesting comment. Historically, I think there is no question that prayer in the schools and the public schools themselves were designed to promote Protestant values, and prayer accompanied that. As to the current move, I would distinguish, as we've been doing before, between children praying in classrooms after school as not part of a school-sponsored exercise. I don't see why the state should be hostile to religion and prohibit them from doing that. And it's not at all clear to me that they could be successful in doing so. I do think that the movement to have the state itself engage in prayer is a partially an attempt to evangelize. I think it is also partially an attempt to recover something that they believe has been lost, that the belief that we are a Christian nation, and in order to show that we are a Christian nation, we should have Christian prayers in schools to demonstrate that. Hmm. I think in our increasingly pluralistic society that is deeply problematic. Indeed, go ahead.
No, pardon me for interrupting. Go ahead.
I read something by a very prominent sociologist of religion who says that in 40 years, the second most sizable religious group in the country will be Muslims, mm-hmm. Which gives you some idea of just how pluralistic our country is becoming in terms of religion.
And I just felt, like, again, sort of compelled to make the point that also that if a student, if at some point during the school day, a student sitting in her desk wanted to briefly bow her head and say a silent prayer, no one's going to stop her. I've talked about this issue a long time ago with someone who was a law professor here at this university, Ron Rotunda. I don't know if you know him.
I do.
His joke always was, as long as there are finals, there will be prayer in school.
That's very good.
And that there was nothing to stop that. The issue here is this an organized activity led by a teacher or school official? That's the catch. And what individuals want to do on their own, they're perfectly free to do.
I think it's worthwhile pointing out at this stage that the current majority of the United States Supreme Court I believe, is going to move us further away from the regulatory ideal of separation of church and state. The current majority of the Supreme Court doesn't believe in the idea of church and state. They believe in building bridges between church and state, accommodation of church and state. So the reigning doctrine on the court has been that the state, with the exception of In God We Trust and the like, may not endorse religion. So there was a case in Allegheny County in a courthouse in which there was a creche, Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, a nativity scene. And the court struck that down, said that the state can't have that nativity scene. But four justices dissented and said that the state can have religious displays so long as they are not proselytizing and so long as they are not permanent. So during the Christmas season, for example, I believe there is now a majority of the Supreme Court that would say that in a public school there could be a religious display. It would be harder in a public school because of the presence of small children, so it might be looked upon as proselytizing. But I'm quite confident that in a courthouse in public, this court is prepared to reverse what it did in the Allegheny County case.
We have some other callers. Let me just quickly introduce again the guest for this hour of Focus, Stephen Schifrin. He's professor of law at Cornell University Law School, teaches constitutional law and First Amendment, and we're talking about religion in the public school. Questions welcome, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. You may also email will-talk@illinois.edu. And we do indeed have some other questions here from people who are listening, and we'll go next to Urbana, line three. Hello.
Hello. Two quick comments. The portion of the Pledge of Allegiance in One Nation Under God was inserted in the early 1950s, I believe. The other was that your comment that the Constitution was written, and I paraphrase you, in an environment of profound profoundly religious environment, which I think was true. The irony being that the people who wrote the Constitution were almost all deists. Would you comment on that, please?
I guess I would say this. First of all, as to the Pledge of Allegiance putting under God in the 1950s, it's also true that the currency which added under God or In God We Trust was in the Civil War. The use of God by presidents goes back to the beginning. Washington was thought that the presence of religion in a polity was vitally important. Certainly Lincoln's Gettysburg Address and most of his speeches are religiously tinged, if not saturated.
Certainly true.
As to the founders being deists, they were many of the founders were deists, and many of the founders were not. There was a conflict between Jefferson and Madison. Jefferson hoped that institutional religion would go away. Madison hoped that institutional religions would flourish. Madison turned out to be right. I have never subscribed to the view that we should be bound by the intent of the framers. I've never understood why a group of slaveholders and old men should be dictating to us in the 21st century. I think we interpret a constitution in terms of a variety of factors, including the history in which it has developed.
My only further comment would be that I was not implying that there should not be religion, and that George Washington, who constantly used religious metaphors and language was unquestionably a deist, which is not an atheist by any matter of means, and that the same is probably true of Abraham Lincoln. And is probably true of many of the people who use religion in politics today.
Let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. The concept of deist, one conception of deist is that God created the world and then stayed out of the rest of it.
The great watchmaker.
Yes. But my impression is that, and this is, I'm sorry I'm blanking on the name of the book, but that the concept of deism at the time of the founding of the Constitution was not confined to that, and that the framers who thought of themselves as deists had quite disparate views. This is a historical question. For legal purposes, I'm not sure what difference the answer makes. But what is your conception of the deistic beliefs of the framers?
I think it was not unanimous. It certainly ranged from Adams, who was a Unitarian, and to perhaps some of the more extreme who would have gone back to the Great Watchmaker.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them, I think, denied the divinity of Christ. Certainly that was Jefferson's point of view.
Certainly was Jefferson's point of view. I'm not sure that I could concur that most of them denied the divinity of Christ. But I do think that there were a large number of Unitarians who did.
I think so. But there was a range of views.
Yes.
And they were certainly not what we would call fundamentalist Christians today.
And in fact, you know, the general public impression that they were more religious than is currently the case, the sociological, historical evidence seems to be that they, for the most part, were not churchgoers, that about 10% of people at the time of the founding of the Constitution went to church, whereas now it's 40%.
I need to jump in here. We're getting into about our last 10 minutes of the program, and I have another caller here I want to thank the last caller and go on to Champaign County, and this is line two. Hello.
Before I forget it, there's another opportunity to see and discuss the film, and that's tomorrow night at the Art Theater. And it's a benefit for the ACLU, if I recall. Check your local listings. It's in downtown Champaign. And I think both Jay Rosenstein and Daniel McCollum will be there as well. Earlier you mentioned the 17% of, let's call them secularists, just to be short. That actually, from the Pew studies of some time ago, was actually, I think, was cited as being the group that's expanding the most. I mean, of the religions, Islam is gaining more adherence. But if you look overall, I believe the most expanding category is secularity. And I see that as a good trend myself. But I just wanted you to confirm if you can, whether that's true or not. And the other thing is we have this local instance, and maybe it's too complicated, but I'd like to at least point at it, and that's the religious instructor at the U of I who sent out emails about his belief that natural theory of life or something what made him believe that homosexuality was abhorrent or something or evil. And it was handled very poorly, I think, on all sides. I'm not sure what should have really been resolved, but it pointed out that the U of I had this rather medieval system where the Newman Center or some group of the Catholic Church was actually paying the salary of the religious instructor who was teaching modern Catholic thought. I just found that shocking, and if nothing else, the whole brouhaha at least exposed that this was still the case, and I gather this was historically the case, but most universities throughout the country had abandoned that many years ago. I'll hang up and listen since time is short. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
What university did he say this occurred at?
This was our university, and it's a very complicated case, probably too complicated to explain. But it did indeed involve someone who was teaching a class on contemporary Catholic thought, whose salary was paid by the Catholic Church, and there was a great dispute over his talking about and whether he was advocating. Whether in fact he was proselytizing or whether he was simply saying, well, this is what the Catholic Church teaches, and the controversy surrounded comments that he made about homosexuality. And it was and continues to be very, very controversial because some people say that academic freedom here is an issue that's at stake.
Oh, I think it's clear that academic freedom is at stake. I think the question of a public university accepting contributions from a religious institution is a more interesting and complicated issue. I tend to think it should be okay, actually, but it's something I would want to think about. Mm-hmm. About the point that he made about the growing number of secularists in the United States, it might be the most rapidly expanding group. The point I made about Muslims growing and being the second largest, likely to become the second largest religious group in a few decades, was not didn't include secularists who are not a religious group, and also. Squeezes all Protestants, scatters all Protestants. So obviously Protestants will be more than Muslims. But if you divide them into Episcopalians, Southern Baptists, and so forth, Muslims will exceed those particular groups is what this sociologist believes. Another surprising statistic is that the second a very large group in the United States, larger than other religious groups, are those people who have left Catholicism. So Catholicism is the largest denomination at the moment. And if you counted it as a denomination, the second largest group would be those who had left the Catholic Church. That is masked by the fact that immigration is building the ranks of the Catholic Church.
Yeah. We're shorting time here, and I want to get in some of the thoughts of somebody who sent an email here because I think she raised some interesting questions and points out the fact that I started out talking about the results of this the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life survey of religious knowledge of Americans. And she says, starting out with that and then declaring the U.S. is a deeply religious nation, she says, is, quote, an oxymoron of stupendous proportions. And I think that she is referring to the fact that while many Americans say they are religious, what this survey shows is that people are deeply ignorant of what various religions teach, sometimes even their own. And she goes on to say that she certainly didn't want anything taught, any state-endorsed religious PAP, to use her word, that is non-denominational and generic but pervasive. She says she doesn't want that in the public schools. I think that some people have responded to this poll by arguing that what it shows is we should be teaching about religion in schools, that it is a kind of cultural literacy issue, and that people's misunderstanding of rulings about religion in school has led to schools taking a position that, to be on the safe side, they're just not going to mention religion at all. And that what we really need to do is be talking about religion in school, but to go back to that phrase I used at the beginning, but not preaching it, but teaching it.
I would make two points. The first I would make is I agree with you to the extent you were saying that this is an issue of cultural literacy And that in our society, particularly given the importance of religion in our society, it is disgraceful that citizens don't know about the content of religious views, particularly when there are so many issues in our political life in which religion makes a difference, or in which the views of people are motored by religion. The second general point I would make is that I believe the Supreme Court is increasingly going to be upholding legislation and saying it doesn't violate the Establishment Clause. And therefore, the questions of the relationship between church and state are more likely to be fought out in political life than in courts. Mm. And if they are fought in political life, the most convincing argument to make in support of the Establishment Clause, in my view, is that tight connections between church and state are damaging to religion. And in order to further that contention, one has to engage in a theological discussion about what's good for religion and what's bad for religion and what the purpose of religion is. And the more the population is not literate about religion, the battle between the religious right and the religious left is going to take place with people who have about an eighth grade understanding of religion. I believe the vast middle of the country can be moved toward a view that tight connections between church and state are bad for religion. I do not believe they will be moved by secular arguments.
Hmm. Well, can you flesh that out just a little bit? I mean, why are tight connections between church and state bad for religion?
First of all, I think that the use of religious symbols, take the Ten Commandments. There have been a few cases involving the Ten Commandments. Those cases started out in which I believe that politicians wanting to curry favor with their constituents, Cecil B. DeMille, who had made a movie for commercial purposes, wanted to promote the Ten Commandments. Mm-hmm. The Ten Commandments itself has many translations. And so the government was deciding which translation of the Ten Commandments was best. That has to be bad for a religion. In terms of financial aid to religion, the whole history of Europe shows that when the church has close connections with the state, that the church will lose when the state is perceived to be corrupt. And I believe that the decline of the Catholic Church in Spain, in Italy, in Portugal, in France, has taken place in part, in large part, because of their tight connections. Whereas in Ireland, where there were not tight connections between church and state, there was religion flourish.
We're very short on time. I have a couple of callers. I want to try to get at least one of them. I'll go to Champagne and line number two right here. Hello.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
I disagree with your guess that secular humanism is not a state cult. I suggest that secular humanism is the result of John Dewey, and it's trying to use pagan values to solve pagan problems which have crept into organized religion. Therefore, getting rid of religion in the schools and substituting a state secular humanism exploring immorality, claiming that it's all okay as long as you sign up and go fight for Uncle Sam, and an agenda which is not patriotic and is basically anti-American in its values, is self-defeating. Therefore, I would take issue with practically everything that your guest said, although I'm sure he's well-intended. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, you can, Professor Schifrin, you can respond to that however you like.
Well, in my book, the book I mentioned, The Religious Left and Church-State Relations, I discuss this problem, and I have sympathy for the view of Christian evangelicals who believe that their attitudes are not taken seriously, that their religion is essentially being denied by the public schools. I would point out that, in fact, the government does deny the truth implicitly, denies the truth of a number of religions. For example, we have a Defense Department. implicitly, this says the Quakers are wrong. Many schools teach sex education, and they teach the use of birth control, which essentially is saying that the Catholics are wrong. There are Friday night football games, which essentially is saying that Orthodox Jews are wrong. Nonetheless, none of these are an establishment of religion under law. The secular humanism to which the person refers, secular humanism doesn't teach that God exists, but it doesn't teach that God doesn't exist or that there is doubt about whether God exists. It simply doesn't take a position on the subject. The teaching of evolution in the schools doesn't address the question of whether God exists or not. I'm not sure what the alternative the listener had in mind. Is it the listener's view that the Presbyterian Church should be able to control the schools in some city in our country? It's hard to understand how that could be consistent with establishment of religion. Go ahead.
Forgive me again for interrupting there, but we're going to have to stop because we've come to the end of the time. And so we're going to have to close the discussion for right now. I'm sure on other days we'll get back to some of these issues. I do, again, want to mention that if folks are interested in seeing this documentary that I have talked about, it's about one of the earliest cases that has to do with religion in public schools, McCollum v. Board of Education, and originated in Champaign and went to the Supreme Court. We're showing this documentary, The Lord Is Not on Trial Here, next week on Tuesday evening at 7 on our station, WYLO-TV, and then also on Friday, we'll be showing it at 7:30, and after that, the filmmaker Jay Rosenstein and Dan McCollum will be here in the studio with us to talk about that. And also, if you're interested in reading some more on these issues, you might look for the book that our guest, Stephen Schifrin, has authored, The Religious Left and Church-State Relations, published by the Princeton University Press. Stephen Schifrin is professor of law at Cornell Law School. We want to say also thanks to Glenn Palmer, who's the technical director on the other end, so we could have this good, nice, high-quality connection. And to you, Professor Schifrin, thank you very much for giving us your time today.
Thank you, David. It was a pleasure.